think there are three components of populism. There's a sort of people-centrism, there's an anti-pluralism, and everything's described in terms of morality. And then the final element is this sort of nationalism, primarily emphasized around nativism. And these three things seem to be electorally popular amongst a wide swath of people from the left, the center, and the right.
Welcome to A History of Xenophobia, from the gold mines to the rise of the far right today. My name is Ariel Glynn, and I'm the host of this History Hope podcast series. History Hope is based at the School of History at University College Dublin in Ireland. You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhope.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhope.ie. For this podcast, I'll be talking to Matt Golder. Matt is a professor in the Department of Political Science at Penn State University in the United States. His research focuses on political representation. In addition to writing articles in a variety of journals, he has also published two books, Principles of Comparative Politics and Foundations in Comparative Politics. He's currently one of the team leaders on an international project looking at populism and the future of democracy, and has written extensively on the far right. Of particular interest for this podcast are his articles entitled Explaining Variation in the Success of Extreme Right Parties in West Europe and Far Right Parties in Europe. So we're delighted to have Matt on the podcast today. Maybe to start, why do you use the term far right? Cass Mudde, who you reference, uses the radical right. So why do you prefer the term far right?
Yeah, there's a lot of different terminology used by different people, and they actually refer to slightly different things. So I use the term far right because I was because as a sort of broad umbrella category that captures different types of parties that they're on the right, but they're not in what we call the mainstream right. So these are right-wing parties that are not the Conservative Party or the Christian Democratic Party or the Liberal Party. And then underneath that umbrella, we can think of the extreme right. These are groups and parties that are opposed to democracy. And then we also have the radical right. And so these are parties and groups that are anti-system, but not necessarily anti-democratic. And when we think of electorally successful far-right parties today, we're talking mainly about the radical right. And those radical right parties share a certain ideology. They sort of combine radicalism with populism and nationalism. And so that's the reason why we have different scholars talking about the radical right. Sometimes they call them the populist right, and sometimes they call them the populist radical right. But we're mainly talking about radical right parties.
One of the other issues that people might be confused by is the fact that while we usually term them on the far right or the radical right, that some of their economic policies are quite similar to some of those put forward by the left in terms of economic policies regarding social welfare, albeit in a kind of chauvinistic way. You know, this welfare chauvinism is something that they use. So where are they on the traditional left-right political spectrum?
Yeah, so we often think about European party systems as, at least since the period of industrialization, as having this sort of traditional left-right spectrum where we're talking about if you're on the right, we want less state intervention in the economy, and when we're on the left, we want more state intervention in the economy. Far-right parties don't fit easily onto that dimension. In terms of economic policy, at least today, we see far-right parties running from right-wing economic policies to left-wing economic policies to centrist economic policies. We tend, though, as you've indicated, to see that their economic policies, wherever they're located, tend to be sort of based around nativist policies, welfare chauvinism. They always come with this strong populist and nativist tinge. The other thing to recognize is that these far-right parties tend not to emphasize their economic policy to some extent beyond their desire to emphasize their nativism, because I think that if we're going to fight on the economic dimension, I think that they're expecting to lose. We have traditional parties that are located on these and have issue ownership over those dimensions. And so far-right parties tend to try and de-emphasize economic policy, partly because they also are drawing from left-wing voters and right-wing voters. And so to focus in on economic policy is kind of counterproductive. They want to focus in on this sort of a social dimension or a social conservatism dimension or an immigration dimension.
Yeah. So identity, values, you know, I just moved back from the Netherlands after living there for 7 years, and the amount of emphasis on cultural values was incredible, and how that, you know, they had ownership of it, as you say, but then the center right very much embraced it as well.
Yeah, I think it's very hard for the center right parties to embrace those. In many cases, those center right parties have tried to win back those far right voters. But if they haven't done that early enough, then the far-right parties have got ownership of those issues. And essentially what those mainstream right parties are doing, they're not winning back those voters. They're just making that issue more salient and potentially strengthening the far-right.
You talk about certain voters being attracted from the right, from center-right, let's say, and also certain voters being attracted from the left. Who are these voters, you know, if it's possible? Obviously, you can't pinpoint, but generally?
Well, it's difficult to know. I mean, it's hard to say that there's a specific right-wing far-right voter. We know that they tend to be male. We know that they're often young. But you're right, they come from both the left and the right. Some of the people were voting, say, in the UK for the Labour Party, and some of them have been voting for the Conservative Party. We have some ideas as to what types of voters, what kind of factors drive people towards the far right. So some scholars sort of focus in on the voters as what they call losers of the modernization process, or modernization losers. So we've had this sort of process of economic development since the Second World War, where we've shifted from perhaps what we might think of it as an industrial society to a post-industrial society. And obviously the economy has become more globalized. And these changes result in winners and losers. And the idea is that people that are losing from this process are the ones that are voting for the far right. And they're losing because in the past, they probably would have been key actors in the sort of post-war European economic model, that they had status, they had guaranteed jobs, they were bringing in stable incomes. And those jobs, for many of these groups, they're gone. And the associations and the trade unions that used to give people a sense of community and an identity, they're much, much weaker. And so we have these sort of more isolated individuals that are essentially losing their status. And mainstream parties, for many of them, are not responding. They're not addressing the types of issues that these people are struggling with. And therefore, far-right parties can come along with very sort of simplistic and nativist messages that provide an explanation for why they're hurting, who's to blame, and they can point to an idealized image of the past where things were much better. I wouldn't say that these people that vote for the far-right are necessarily at the very, very bottom of the social hierarchy. We're talking about people that are towards the bottom of the social hierarchy, but have still got something to lose. And they're still trying to maintain a certain status or position to separate themselves from the people at the very bottom.
Yeah, and there's also this idea, this perception that they're losing, or they're potentially going to lose, you know, that they might be in actually stable enough employment, but they might have this inkling that things will change, or they are not part of the future that's professed by other, let's say, more progressive parties. So, you know, sometimes on this spectrum that I mentioned earlier, Engelhardt and Norris talk about, let's say, the green left kind of being on the opposite end of this, and they would feel that this doesn't appeal to them at all. So you say in some of your research that sometimes it's a kind of coalition of small business owners and white collar workers on the right, and then blue collar workers and the unemployed on the left. But obviously that includes huge swaths of the population, and not all of those people are voting for these far right parties.
So, absolutely. Yeah, and it is this cross-class coalition of voters that are attracted to the far right, which is why the far right can't necessarily focus in on economic policy so much. They're holding these people together primarily with a focus on sort of nativism in sort of immigration and anti-minority types of policies.
Yeah, and patriotism as well, you know, nationalism, as you mentioned. I noticed, you know, you're from Britain, and there's a report recently about Labour, that Labour needs to fly the flag more. You know, that it needs to be more patriotic, embrace kind of Britain and the British flag. And even reading this book by Paul Emery called Despised, I don't know if you know it, but he's from the kind of the blue left, blue Labour, but talking about very much proud to be British, and that this is despised by, let's say, the more intellectual wing of Labour.
Yeah, so I think the far right, one of their key ideological elements is certainly nationalism. Obviously, your listeners have a sense of what that is. It's basically the congruence between the state and the nation. Far-right parties approach nationalism in slightly different ways. Some far-right parties promote a more sort of civic form of nationalism, where anyone could become a member of the nation, but they have to assimilate to certain cultural values. And then others sort of promote a more sort of ethnic form of nationalism, where if you don't belong to the right ethnic group, then you can't really ever become a true member of the nation. And obviously, a key element that separates the nationalism of some of the mainstream parties from the nationalism of the sort of far-right parties is the sort of nativist component, which sort of combines nationalism with a sort of fear of the outsider, or xenophobia. I also think that it's useful when we often think about far-right parties, we often think they're often portrayed in this sort of, the nationalism is based around a racism, a sort of a superiority over other groups. It's not clear, at least in public statements, that's they don't really publicly announce that. And so it's sort of implicit, perhaps, in some of their arguments. At least the public utterations are sort of based around a sort of ethno-pluralist view of nationalism, which is a lot more palatable, which is why it may attract some more sort of centrist people. This is the idea that there are lots of distinct cultures, and each of these cultures are in some sense equal and valuable, and we want to protect those cultures. And so we want to, this cultural mixing from mass immigration is sort of graying the different colors of all these cultures. And so at least this is the palatable sort of public version of the type of nationalism and nativism. They want to protect English culture or British culture. And that means other cultures are fine, they should just happen somewhere else.
Yeah, I know. I also lived in Italy, and I remember how the Alleanza Nazionale, the National Alliance, right, kind of sanitized the party. You know, it had these post-fascist links. But then the leader at the time, Gianfranco Fini, he goes to Israel. You know, he makes a lot of links with Jewish organizations to try and show, no, we're not the old fascist party of before. We're, as you say, kind of open, multi-pluralists. It's just that we have our own kind of vision of Italian society and identity. So it is that kind of, they mightn't say it, but at least in relation to some parties, it's there if you dig down.
Yeah, certainly amongst the membership and the voters, you can certainly see those elements. But parties definitely, like you said, have tried to sort of sanitize their image. These parties that we're talking about today are really not fascist parties or neo-fascist parties. Some of them had ties when they first emerged to those groups. But those types of parties are not necessarily the most successful ones. The most successful ones are the ones that, at least from the public point of view, have sanitized their image to a certain extent. I think most people would still consider it a sort of a troubling view of separating out different minorities and immigrant groups, but it's certainly a more palatable version.
Yeah, sometimes I make the link in my classes between, let's say, compare Jean-Marie Le Pen with his daughter, that, right, you know, he was quite openly anti-Semitic at times, whereas his daughter, Marine Le Pen, would never say something like that openly, and because she is fearful that they would be viewed as extremists. She wants to appeal to a broader public. And usually she wants to get away from that past. She wants to reach more people. And so it's quite different, this message.
And I think these parties have been very successful at doing this.
You talk, or some people speak about a master frame when it comes to the appeal of far-right parties. What exactly is this?
Yeah, so a sociologist, Jens Rydgren, sort of described the ideological appeal of these successful contemporary far-right parties as a master frame. And basically, this is a combination of radicalism, populism, and nationalism. And so, as he indicates, sort of radicalism is about being anti-system. You're against the current system, but you're not against democracy. And obviously, what that system is that you're fighting against can vary across different contexts. In most European countries, sort of the radicalism on the right is against liberal democracy. We have obviously left-wing radicals, and they're fighting against the capitalist system. The second component of the master of the frame is populism. Populism, I think, is misunderstood by a lot of people. I sort of see it as a discursive style, or what some people think of as a thin ideology, where you sort of view society as divided into these two groups, the pure people and the corrupt elite. And I think there are three components of populism. There's a sort of people-centrism, there's an anti-pluralism, and then everything's described in terms of morality. And then the final element is this sort of nationalism that's primarily emphasized around nativism. And these three things seem to be electorally popular amongst a wide swath of people from both the left, the center, and the right.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why they have to tone down, let's say, this nativism at times is because some of their voters mightn't agree with their views on immigration, but they might agree with their views about the elite system, about the about the state not listening to it. So some of my students in the Netherlands used to do interviews with people who voted for these kind of parties, and you know, they were quite surprised at times that the people that they interviewed didn't have any negative views about immigration, but they did have negative views about the European Union, about the kind of more mainstream general parties who they felt that they had ignored or neglected the normal people. So it's as you say, that it's this combination that allows them to gain a huge amount of voters, but not all voters necessarily agree with all three dimensions that you mentioned.
Right. And I think the far right parties are benefiting from the fact that there's sort of been a de-alignment of voters in Europe. Oftentimes in the past, people had these sort of traditional attachments, very strong partisanship with particular parties. So, for example, if your parents were Labour voters, then you might grow up in a Labour household, and then you yourself would become a Labour voter or a Conservative Party voter if that was your family lineage. And that's just not the case. Those kind of high levels of partisanship and connections with the parties are just breaking down. And what that means is that there's this big pool of voters that are kind of fluid, that make their minds up election by election. And for many of these sort of fluid voters or people that can switch their vote, those mainstream parties are essentially identical. For them, it doesn't really matter whether you have a left-wing government or a right-wing government, because they implement the same policies. Nobody is addressing the types of issues that these people are concerned about. And they don't seem to have an answer. I mean, we've had globalization now for the last sort of 40 or 50 years since the 70s. And nobody is listening to the people that have been losing out through that process, or at least that's the perception of this segment of the electorate.
Yeah, I know Peter Mayer in his book Ruling the Void has certain graphs that show voter volatility over, you know, since 1945. And, you know, he has a table with maybe 15 or 20 countries, and you really see that the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s are when this voter volatility is going all over the place, because, as you say, people don't have loyalty anymore to these traditional parties. And, you know, there's a certain degree of truth to what they say as well, in that there are a lot of coalitions in places like Germany, in the Netherlands, elsewhere, between, let's say, the center-right and the center-left. So that sometimes makes them indistinguishable in the public mind in comparison to these obvious kind of cleavages in the past.
Yeah, I mean, there was a sort of a famous theory, and like, I guess there's still a debate about it in political science, about how up until sort of the 1960s and 1970s, European party systems have been frozen, that there hadn't been much change in European party systems for the past 50 or 60 years. Parties that were winning in the 1920s were still winning in the 1960s and 1970s. And part of the reason for that was that the cleavage structure in European societies hadn't really changed. We'd had sort of the pre-industrial cleavages, so we now have sort of religious parties and sort of parties that focus on the agricultural sector, and then we had the industrial revolution, and so now we got sort of class-based parties. But there hadn't been any changes to the cleavage, so there were no new segments or no new dimensions for a new party to run on. There were no voters to grab. But that did begin to change in the 60s. So we often talk about this shift to a sort of a post-industrial society where people were less concerned about their material issues and they were more concerned with sort of individual freedoms and gender equality and racial equality and the environment. And as you mentioned earlier, the first parties, the new parties that were able to leverage that, because the mainstream parties were very, very slow to react to these changes in society, were parties on the left. We call them the left libertarian parties. We can think of the Greens as sort of the people that have survived from that period. And for some far-right scholars, the emergence of new far-right parties or the sudden jump in support for far-right parties in the 80s and the 1990s was a response, a reaction, a backlash to the types of changes to traditional values that were being promoted by these left libertarian parties. And it was the emergence of this new dimension that sort of broke up this new system. And so instead of everything being on a left-right dimension, we now have two dimensions. And so this is what allows those far-right parties to be anywhere on the economic dimension, but they're up that traditional social conservative end on the social dimension.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but it brings up kind of the argument of Engelhardt and Norris that this cultural backlash that you're referring to is more salient than the economic insecurity kind of idea. That is, that there's competition for people for less resources than before. Do you agree with their argument, or do you feel that it's more complicated, that you can't pick one or the other because they're both dependent, interdependent?
I think it's difficult. I think if you were to survey most far-right scholars, you would find that people are going to put a lot of emphasis on the cultural backlash. I think, at least when we're talking about individual level factors that drive people to vote for the far-right, we know that people who are competing in the economic sphere with immigrants are more likely to vote for far-right parties. We know that people who hold anti-immigrant attitudes are more likely to vote for far-right parties. There's no surprise there. The question becomes, those people who hold the anti-immigrant attitudes, is that primarily because they're worried about economic concerns, or are they primarily worried about sort of cultural concerns? There have been one or two studies that try and separate out those two things. It's very hard to do. They suggest that both economic and cultural concerns matter, but perhaps there's a little bit more weight on sort of cultural concerns. But that's at the individual level. Sort of when we think about the sort of context in which people live, then things are a little bit less clear. So, for example, we don't really have strong evidence that if you live in a community with more immigrants, that you're more likely to vote for far-right parties. We don't have strong evidence that if you live in a community that's suffering from high unemployment or high economic scarcity, you necessarily vote for far-right parties. I think the story there is a lot more complicated. And I kind of like the theory that's sort of been put out there by Rafaela Danziger. She argues that economic scarcity matters, but primarily only when sort of immigrant and minority communities have political power. Because what happens then is, when immigrants are pivotal, immigrant communities or minority communities are pivotal in deciding elections, then the incumbents have to transfer state material goods to the immigrant community, which means the native population don't have as much material goods as they were having in the past. And that creates a conflict between the immigrant community and the native population. And that's something that far-right parties get to exploit. And so it's this combination of economic scarcity with political or electoral power on the part of immigrant and minority communities. And again, some immigrant communities have this electoral power. They've been able to collectively organize. Some don't. It kind of depends on whether the state is the primary way in which material goods are being allocated or whether it's more of a free market society. And so it's very, very complicated. So I actually like the economic story, but it's very hard to put together and it's very hard to test.
Yeah, I really like in your article, Far-Right Parties in Europe, you talk about this spatial distribution and how complicated it is that you can have two city or different areas within a city with similar percentages of immigrants, sometimes with very different voting patterns.
Yeah, somebody who's trying to analyze this and trying to come up with the sort of right quantitative model, it's tricky because you have the individual level factors and they're situated within a local community, and each of those local communities are situated within a national story, and those national countries are sort of situated in sort of deal interactions with the European Union or a globalized economy that's also influencing people's attitudes. It's an incredibly difficult story, which is why we tend to just sort of focus in on one element at a time. And hopefully at some stage we can sort of put those things together.
Maybe just bring in the historical dimension. I know Claudia Golden, who's done some very good historical work on the political economy of the United States and late 19th and early 20th century, she was looking at voting patterns in that period, especially on various attempts to bring in restrictions such as the Literacy Act into the United States. And she said there comes a kind of tipping point if cities or states have more than, I think she thought it was over 25 or 30% of the populations were immigrant or immigrant parents, then they would tend to be more in favor of allowing more immigrants to come in, or wouldn't be as beholden to restrictions, whereas those below that space, then they are more inclined towards restriction. But obviously, if you apply that to elsewhere, it might necessarily correlate with what occurs in reality. When we talked about the cultural backlash and economic insecurity, these are something that are often referred to as kind of demand side factors. Can you explain to people who don't know what we're talking about, what are these demand side factors and where did they come from?
Sure, we can think of far right supporters being driven by demand side factors and by sort of supply side factors. So demand side factors are the things that push people towards supporting for far-right parties. They're the grievances that create the demand for far-right parties. We've talked about some of these grievances. There are the grievances that come from the modernization process. Then there are sort of the grievances, economic grievances, where we're talking about economic scarcity or insecurity. And then we have the cultural grievances. So these are the things that are driving individual preferences or demand for far-right parties. And then we have on the other side, sort of supply-side factors. One way of thinking about these are sort of pull factors. These are things that far-right parties can do the actions that the party leaders can do to attract people. So what are the types of ideology that we're putting forward, or the types of policies? But they're also on the supply side, we have the political opportunity structure. These are, the political opportunity structure is really about the extent to which a political system is open to a new party or a smaller party like far-right parties. They've been growing, but relatively speaking, they're still smaller than the mainstream parties. So in terms of the political opportunity structure, we're talking about, is the electoral system a sort of a majoritarian or a proportional one? Smaller, newer parties do better with proportional systems. How do the mainstream parties respond when a far-right party emerges? Do they do they ignore the far-right parties, or do they try and sort of steal their positions? How do the media react? And so we have this sort of interaction between demand-side factors and supply-side factors that together go to drive the level of far-right support in a country.
You talk about how high demand and open supply are both necessary for successful far-right parties. Now, hopefully we're not bombarding listeners with different concepts and theories, but you know, you explained there that supply-side factors are typically more top-down. You know, they come from the organization of parties, from leaders, from this sanitization of parties that we spoke about. So could you then say why high demand is necessary and open supply how they go together?
Yeah, so to be honest, I think most of the existing literature sort of recognizes that demand-side factors matter and supply-side factors matter, but they're often treated separately. We might stick variables that capture these two things in the same model, but again, they're treated independently of each other. And I think this is a little wrong. So we can think about it like this. You can have a country that has a very high demand for far-right parties. There are a lot of people that like the policies of far-right parties. But if the political opportunity structure, the supply side is closed, so you have a majoritarian electoral system, it's going to be very hard for far-right parties to win seats in the legislature and to get into government, because majoritarian systems benefit large parties and they hurt smaller, more extreme parties. So just simply having high demand in a country, having lots of people with sort of anti-immigrant attitudes or worried about economic scarcity, that won't translate unless the political opportunity structure is open. And similarly, you can have a political opportunity structure that's open, but if you have nobody who wants to vote for a far-right party, you're not going to get a lot of far-right parties in the legislature. It's that combination of a high demand with an open supply structure, an open political opportunity structure that allows the demand to appear in the legislature and in the governments.
I think a good example that I sometimes reference for my students here in Ireland is Ireland itself, in that after the economic crisis in 2008, you had, according to surveys, you know, increasing racism, xenophobic kind of feelings because of increased scarcity. You know, unemployment went to around 15%. There was, in a short amount of time, a kind of demographic revolution in that the amount of people who were born outside Ireland increased to from almost, you know, zero to almost one in five. But there was no open supply because the main party that's been identified by certain scholars as low, you know, that would take up these kind of voters is Sinn Féin. Yet Sinn Féin has a quite pro-immigrant stance, quite, you know, because of its history as representing a minority in the north of Ireland. It's very hesitant to turn its back on other minorities. You know, that if you go up to the Falls Road in Belfast, you see all these murals of Frederick Douglass, of you know, the struggles for apartheid or to break apartheid with Mandela, Palestinian struggles, Basque struggles, all these kind of different links with minorities who are struggling. So they can't embrace this anti-immigration stance, and they don't have those sentiments generally, the politicians, but some of their voters might. But because there's no open supply, this has yet to emerge, although I think it will. But it's just,
this is really sort of a crucial point. If you were to survey lots of European countries, you would find high levels of anti-immigrant attitudes in most European countries. But there's huge variation in the legislative representation of far-right parties. If that sort of latent anti-immigrant sort of social conservatism to some extent is sort of somewhat constant and high across countries, there can only be one explanation for why we've got variation in legislative seats, and that's the institutional structure and the supply of these parties varies, and that's what's creating this variation in support across European countries.
So what strategies, you mentioned very briefly near the start that, you know, how central-right parties can react to the growth of these anti or these far-right parties. But what are the different approaches that mainstream parties can adapt? And do we know if one is more successful than the other?
Yeah, so I think there are sort of two basic strategies that mainstream right parties can adopt. They can choose to ignore far-right parties, or they can choose to sort of, what we say, adopt an accommodating strategy. So the goal of ignoring far-right parties is fairly straightforward. It's to not give them any voice, to keep the issues that far-right parties are talking about less salient. And so you don't want to be talking about issues like immigration. You don't want to be talking about issues related to, say, the European Union. And if you don't talk about it, then lots of voters won't think of those issues as being salient when they go to vote. So that's one strategy. And it's a strategy that I think a lot of mainstream right parties have historically adopted. The other is sort of an accommodating strategy. And the goal here is to change your own policy positions, to move them closer to the policy positions of the far right in order to win back far right voters. But to be honest, I think this is an incredibly dangerous strategy for mainstream right parties, because when we think about electoral competition, it's not just about competing policy positions. We're also talking about issue ownership and issue salience. And voters simply view far-right parties as more credible on some of these issues, such as immigration. They've held the same position on these policies year after year after year. They've had to make the same statements, whereas mainstream parties, suddenly they're pro-immigration and now they want to become less pro-immigration or they want to be more anti-immigrant. But far-right parties own these issues. And so when you have mainstream right parties talk about these issues, you're just making those issues more salient in the minds of the voters. And they're going to give their vote to the far-right parties because they're viewed as more credible. And so I think that's potentially damaging for the mainstream right parties. If you could get in quickly before those far-right parties have developed their credibility, then perhaps that would work. But it's too late now. And the other thing to think about is, what are the incentives for mainstream left parties? They could choose to ignore the far right, but my sense is that they take a more adversarial approach where they're very critical of the far right. And they should be based on their own, on their policy positions. But when you're critical and outspoken about the far right on these issues, you are again making these issues salient. And I don't think that the left are doing this unthinkingly. By making these issues salient, they are splitting the right-wing vote between the mainstream right and the far right. And that's beneficial to the left. And so we ought to recognize that perhaps part of the left-wing strategy when they're being adversarial is, in some sense, to strengthen the far right. They don't like those policies, but it is electorally beneficial to them. That perhaps is beginning to change now as they're losing some of their voters.
It's a really difficult one for parties on all kind of mainstream parties, how to react, because there are examples that confirm and then contradict some of the theories about what's the best way to react.
Yeah, I think historically the left-wing parties have viewed this adversarial approach as being electorally beneficial. We can go back to one of the sort of first examples was when sort of Mitterrand changed the electoral system in the mid-1980s. He was in a close election with the mainstream right, and he decided to switch from the normal sort of runoff system for legislative elections to a PR system. And the far-right party that had been sort of growing in support but not winning any legislative seats, suddenly in the PR system, they win tons of legislative seats, and that weakens the mainstream right. But this was the breakthrough election for the Front National. And this is what gave them the credibility to survive and be a political force in France from that point in time on. I do think the left-wing parties are beginning, well, I'm hoping that they're beginning to realize perhaps that this strategy is no longer electorally beneficial, that if they want to get into power, they may have to change their adversarial approach on some of these policy dimensions. It's going to be hard because they're clearly ideologically opposed to some of these policies. But they also need to win power if they want to introduce their policies.
Something that my students struggle with, and I also find complicated, is where does the media lie in the demand side, supply side spectrum? Do you have a view on this? Can we associate one or the other?
It's a difficult question. I think the best way of viewing the media is being part of the political opportunity structure. They can either decide whether the political opportunity structure is closed or how open it is. Again, the media have similar strategies that they could adopt to the far right as mainstream parties. They can choose to ignore it, which means that those issues are not going to become salient for large proportions of voters. They could cover the far right in a negative way, and they can cover it in a positive way. Both of these ways of covering, though, increase the salience of these issues. I think part of the concern that people have with the role of the media is this sort of what we think of as media populism, that sort of changes in how media is funded and these commercial pressures to sort of try and get larger audiences and more people to click on articles. is causing people to adopt a more populist approach to the media, a more sort of sensationalist, sort of black and white. People are either good or they're bad. They focus in on the scandals. And these are the sort of bread and water for the far right parties. These are the things that they live on. They want people to view things as black and white. They want people to have a simplistic notions of certain policies and who's to blame and what is the appropriate way to move forward. And so I think these new pressures on the media are perhaps creating an environment where this sort of media populism allows the message of the far right parties to reach more people. And for these issues to become more salient, it creates this openness that allows the demand to be sort of more accurately translated into legislative support for far-right parties.
Yeah, I think one thing I also point out to my students is, and I feel it's not highlighted enough, is that the media is also in turmoil and in crisis in many respects. You know, newspapers are not being bought in the physical format very often anymore. And the internet has obviously complicated things greatly for both broadcast and newspapers. So it's a complicated landscape for them. And as you say, sometimes they new models embrace just getting as many clicks as possible.
Yeah. And coverage of these types of issues does increase that salience. That said, the other side of that story is if you ignore them, then you're just feeding into the far-right party's sort of story that political elites and media elites are colluding to ignore the wishes of the sort of people. It's a tough position to be in.
Yeah. Matt Golder, thanks so much for your time and for giving us so much valuable information about far-right parties in the last while. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhub.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhub.ie.